help me with the pronunciation. Is it Figaro? Figaro?
If I may, I believe it's Figueroa, Your Honor.
Figueroa? All right. Mr. King, ready for you, and do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, sir, if I can do my best to keep track of it on my own, I would like to reserve 5 minutes. I don't know that I'll use my whole allotted time.
All right.
Should I proceed?
Yes, sir, please.
Thank you. May it please the Court. I believe I had the opportunity to outline my position fairly thoroughly in my opening brief, and so I simply refer to that and say that what I'm asking the Court of Appeals to do, of course, is to reverse the ruling of the trial court on the grounds that the trial court erred by finding that it had lawful authority to proceed against Mr. Figueroa in this last proceeding in 2013, which was a revocation proceeding. And the error was that a lawful requisite, a predicate for the court to proceed in 2013, would have been the premise that Mr. Figueroa remained on probation after 2012, and he did not.
Judge Huff, Mr. Figueroa never did. He was aware that a proceeding was taking place. May have been able to raise a defense at it, but didn't appear and never challenged that the result of that hearing. Is that correct?
Almost. I think that the evidence was clear that Mr. Figueroa received what the government may describe as actual notice in the form of a phone call somewhere 24 hours or less before the proceeding from his probation officer, who said, I want you to be in court tomorrow morning because I want to extend your probation. Because, although you're doing well, you haven't paid off your fines and costs. And the evidence was, his response was, I can't be in court tomorrow morning. I have to work. I have to be at work. And so no process had issued, either from the court to compel his appearance or to notify him of a proceeding. No written copy of any pleading was served to him. There was a letter in evidence that was written by the probation officer and sent to the Commonwealth Attorney's Office and at some point filed by someone, which I assume is how it was placed on the docket. But her evidence was also that she never gave him, nor did anyone else give him, a copy of that letter, either before or after the hearing. And as far as I'm aware and from the evidence, he was also never given either a draft proposed order or a copy of any final order. And so my argument has been throughout that even if he had what the government may call actual notice in the form of this phone call, that is not reasonable notice. And the Constitution, rules of court, and as far as I can tell, the statutes themselves at play require reasonable notice. And I would argue that
Mr. King, reasonable notice.
Yes, sir.
This is Judge Petty. We ask you to address the holding in Carbrough versus Commonwealth, which seems to indicate that whereas here there is no definite period of suspension of sentence, the court retains jurisdiction for the maximum period to which he could have been sentenced. Could you tell us what do you think that case applies here? If not, why not?
Yes, sir. Thank you. I don't think it does, because although it did a remarkably good job of parsing the language of the statute at issue at the time, 19.2.306, subsequent to Carbo, the legislature amended the statute and fixed the drafting problem. And so it cleared up the ambiguities that the court was looking at to resolve that case. At this point, the statutory language is fairly clear. And my understanding of the case law is that it is clear that a suspended sentence is separate and distinct from a period of supervised probation, but that the court's authority, the trial court's authority over a suspended sentence is governed by statute, and in this case 19.2.304, 305, or 306. And 306 requires that the court proceed after notice for any cause deemed sufficient during the period of probation, and it just didn't do that. was process issued in 2013, but alleging only violations that occurred after the expiration of probation, according to the court's own orders.
This is Judge McCullough. Can you be more specific about, if you can, about which amendments essentially render Carball time-bound and limited in its scope?
Yes. It's not often that I get to look at legislative history, but in this case, I think it was a single amendment in 2002.
Okay, so a 2002 amendment.
Yes, sir. It's Chapter 628.
I'm sorry, 678?
628.
Oh, 628. Thank you.
Yes,
I can pull that up. The General Assembly seems to have an interest in the statute, and there have been a number of amendments. I just want to make sure I was looking at the one that mattered the most for purposes of your argument. So thank you.
I think had the court's orders been drafted differently, I mean, had the court issued different orders in 2008 at the original sentencing, and then again in 2011 when it basically renewed on the same terms and conditions the 2008 order for a definite period of time, that being from, I think, June of 2011 to June of 2012, with the final date of probation ordered being June 28, 2012, had the court done that differently, we'd have a different case. It is clear from looking at the court's orders that the period of supervised probation included an explicit good behavior requirement in and of itself. There was no additional period of suspension imposed by the court. And under the language of 19.2306, after the amendment, that's what we're left with. There is no other period of authority that extends beyond the terms of the court's own orders in this case, or the statute. At any rate, I think that the process that was, well, first of all, there are two separate grounds that I've argued in the brief and that I'm sticking with an argument today. And that is that, again, there has to be some lawful authority for the court to act in this case, in 2012, and there wasn't any because it had all expired. I mean, after June 28, 2012, Mr. Figueroa simply was no longer a defendant. There was no suspended sentence. He was simply another citizen. And so although the Department of Corrections, Probation and Parole may not like that, and they may have been able to get his case back on the docket by filing this letter somehow, simply too late. The court, on its own initiative, could have, I believe, proceeded against Mr. Figueroa at that time by issuing process, and that would have been pursuant to the statutory scheme in 19.2, starting with 354, and then including 358, which I referenced in my brief, and that governs the procedure for a probationer or any other individuals, any other citizens, alleged failure to timely pay the judgment docketed against him in the form of fines, costs, or maybe restitution. But the court didn't do that. I'd be happy to entertain any questions that Your Honors have, but I think that's the gist of my argument.
I think the briefs were plenty clear, and so I'm satisfied.
Judge Petty, any questions?
No, I have nothing. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. King. By my calculation, you have looks like 8 minutes remaining for rebuttal. Mr. Murphy?
Good morning, Your Honor. This is Gene Murphy for the Commonwealth. Of course, since there was no challenge to the order in August of 2012, the defendant would have to show at this point that that order was void. And, of course, in order to do that, he has to show an absence of subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, now, it's Mr. Murphy, how do you challenge an order if you have no knowledge that it has been entered?
Well, I don't think I don't think he did not have knowledge that the order was being entered. He was told that the proceeding would be held. But in any event,
is that lawful notice?
I'm not sure about that, Your Honor. I'm not sure whether it is, but of course that wasn't challenged. And what we have here is an order. The defendant was aware that his probation had been extended because he did report subsequent to the new order and, in fact, made some payments thereafter, so that I think it's clear he knew about it and failed to challenge it. And it was so at this point the order could be void only if he could demonstrate that, in fact, there was no subject matter jurisdiction. And I think this court's made clear in Mohammed that, in fact, that subject matter jurisdiction is present in a case like this. I think it's even clearer in this case because it's uncontested that at the time that this order was entered, the court was still within the one-year period subsequent to termination of the probation period, during which the court could have entered an order challenging him with a probation violation. So it clearly had subject matter jurisdiction of that event.
But now, in order, this is Judge Petty, in order to extend the probation within that one-year period, the court would have had to revoke and then resuspend, would it not?
It could certainly have done that. It could certainly have revoked.
It could have done that, but it didn't.
The question is,
if it didn't have authority, and I hate to use the word jurisdiction, but it's an authority over the defendant because the period had expired, could he then extend the probation?
Certainly could, Your Honor, because at this point the question is whether or not he had subject matter jurisdiction. I mean, that's the only absence that would render the...
What about jurisdiction over the person?
Well, he certainly had jurisdiction over the person. Certainly had jurisdiction over the defendant at this point, since the court had authority to challenge, to...
Did the court have jurisdiction over the person after the probationary period expired?
Yes, Your Honor, because it still had power to effect a probation violation hearing at that point. It still had it within. Now, there's also, I think Cabo may be helpful. It's correct that Cabo addressed a statute that has now been amended to clear up that ambiguity as to when the violation had to occur. But Cabo still said that the suspension continues when there is no termination period for the suspension of sentence, when no suspension period is specified until the maximum period. So I think one other reason that the court had subject matter jurisdiction at that point was that the suspended sentence continued. So, I mean, it had, you know, you could not... use that item from Cabo to subsequently challenge somebody for a violation that occurred after the probation period had ended. But in fact, it does seem to indicate that the suspended sentence continued. And I think what that, together with the fact that the court had power at that point to entertain a probation violation proceeding, it seems clear that the court had subject matter jurisdiction. In any event, I think if you look at the statute, the question is, if you look at 304, it grants the power of the court the power to extend probation. It doesn't specify a time. So the question is, how long after that probation period ends, does the court have to extend the time? And I think the defendant in this brief suggested a period of 21 days. But I think if you look at the other statutes, but don't forget, this is essentially a probation violation situation when the defendant fails to provide to pay his costs and fees and restitution. So if, in fact, the court can treat that as a probation violation, it could, in fact, at that time when an extended the probation, have entertained a probation violation proceeding and have done everything that it did here. And to make sense of the statute, it seems to me you have to read these statutes together. And, of course, you have a year under 306 after termination in order to deal with any probation violations.
Judge Petty, again, don't you agree, though, that in order to extend that probation after the period of probation is expired for a violation that occurred prior to its expiration, the nonpayment of fines and costs, he would have to find him in violation, guilty, and then revoke the probation and then resuspend it for a period of time.
He couldn't say,
I'm extending your probation without actually revoking it in the first instance.
Well, I think you have to find a violation. Then I'm not sure that he would have to revoke it. I think he could extend the period based on the violation.
Well, if he doesn't revoke it, if he just extends it, then he's amending the final order, which set a fixed probationary period after the 21 days.
Well, but he's empowered to do that under the statute. I mean, certainly, if within the period in 304, there's no question that he could simply extend the period without revoking the suspension. And I think here, all I'm saying is that since the court couldn't go through the cumbersome proceeding of finding him to have violated probation, it makes sense to determine that the period in which he can extend the probation should be identical with that under 306 of 1 year, to give the court the opportunity to take care of this proceeding informally. That is, you know, it may be in everybody's interest for the court to extend the probation period without having to find a violation of probation. I think the trial court actually looked to that when it said that, that it makes sense to give the defendant a further opportunity to avoid being charged with a probation violation. It may be within his interest to have it extended so that they don't have to go to the process of a probation violation when all they want to do is not punish him for that, but merely extend the period during which he has to pay off his costs. And I think, you know, that makes sense that there should be some sort of extended period, because you might have a situation where the defendant is paying regularly for the entire period of his probation, but then misses his final payment, and it's not discovered by the court till after that has occurred. Well, it certainly would make sense at that point to allow the court to extend for a short period during which the defendant could avoid having to deal with a probation violation. And I think, you know, for that reason, the court had the power, but I think essentially the point here is that there's no demonstration that any judgment that the court rendered was void. And clearly, with respect to notice jurisdiction, the same thing applies. It couldn't be clearer that this is failure to give notice if there is a problem, and that it does not render the judgment void when the court had subject matter jurisdiction over this matter, as it clearly did. Unless the court has any further questions, I'll ask that you affirm the decision below.
All right, hearing no further questions, we'll move back to rebuttal. Mr. King?
Thank you. Yes, I have a few points I'll address briefly. One is I have to respectfully disagree with my colleague, Mr. Murphy, that subject matter jurisdiction determines the outcome of this case or the question of whether the court actually had authority to act. Because I don't agree that the case is provided in the briefs, or that the case law that I've been able to find at all makes the leap from one group of jurisdictional problems that are not fatal to subject matter jurisdiction being the only other form that can be problematic. Because subject matter jurisdiction obviously is simply only the power to adjudicate a class of disputes or controversies. And certainly, I guess the language gets confusing in the case law and has crept into the briefing here, but I don't argue that the court didn't have jurisdiction over probation violations or probation extensions generally, and I don't think the answer to that question determines the outcome of this case. Second, I think when Your Honor's were questioning my colleague from the Attorney General's office about notice, and he wasn't able to say, yes, that notice was sufficient. He said, well, I don't really know if that was sufficient, but he contest the substance or the content of the court's order, and the appeal period lapsed. He didn't challenge it, so he loses. He waived that. And I also don't agree that if there's any question about whether notice provided was reasonable, and there certainly is, and I do not concede that what we have in this case comes anywhere close to reasonable notice under the rules of court or the statute or any applicable constitutional due process provisions, that you can then turn around and argue that, well, we're not sure if he had adequate notice, but he waived all of his rights in that proceeding that he maybe didn't have sufficient notice of. And that includes the right to appeal, even though we don't know that he ever got notice of any kind that an order had actually been entered, or when, or what it said, because he was simply remaining in communication with his probation officer.
Suppose he had been served with process and required to appear that day, and the court took the action that it did. Would that change your argument at all?
It would certainly change some of them. Let me think for just a second, if I may.
I mean, would the Attorney General's argument that he would have to challenge the order extending the probation or waive it for future purposes be a valid argument?
If my client had been served written notice in advance of the proceeding, just for hypothetical sake, if he had received a copy of the letter, or ideally it would have been processed at the court, a show cause, to appear in court, if he'd received that, yes, that would certainly change my argument, because then I think the government would have a strong argument that he could be found to have knowingly and intelligently waived his right to appear, seek advice of counsel, contest, be heard, etc. But we know that's not what happened, and I think that's...
But your whole argument rises and falls on whether or not this was sufficient notice, an opportunity to be heard.
Well, that's my whole second assignment of error, I think, rises and falls on that. But I the first one does not. I think whether I would lose in that scenario on the first argument depends on what was served to him and by whom. Because, again, at the trial court, we didn't get into this because I hadn't found it yet. But for your honors to look at the statutory scheme in 192-354 and then in 357 and 358, those sections actually set up a process that the court is to use to bring back to court people who have failed to pay as ordered, both people ordered to pay costs due to criminal proceedings and to other judgments, I believe. And it is clear that that section was at play because I think page 1 of the joint appendix in the bottom left references 192-354. That's the form that goes along with the order to pay costs in installments. And the legislature contemplated that a court could, if it wished, under 192-357, impose an additional good behavior requirement until fines and costs had been paid. The court did not do that in this case. The mechanism available to the court then, under 192-358, upon discovering that a defendant has not timely paid as ordered, is to issue process, and the statute actually contemplates sanctions when it has been demonstrated that individual has not paid as ordered. Jail time can be imposed, etc. And so I think the court could have resorted to that, but didn't. Had the court issued a show cause after June 28, 2012, alleging basically show cause why you should not be found in violation of your probation for failure to pay, I'm not sure off the top of my head what my argument would be. Whether it be different or stronger or weaker. But neither of those happened. I think the court should be cognizant of the government's argument that, well, maybe it didn't go the way it should have, but this court should find that because the court could have issued process up to 1 year after expiration of probation, and even though it didn't, it could have, and that should be good enough. I argue that is not good enough, because if the court were to accept that there was a 1 year period during which the trial court could have issued process, it didn't. There wasn't any. And I think that's the fundamental problem with this case, just that the court speaks those written orders. We know what the court ordered. It was a definite period of probation and a suspended sentence that was coterminous with that period of probation. And the court's order in 2011 was that this period shall extend for 1 year. That year came and went. No process issued either before the case somehow got put back on the docket for end of, I guess, July 2012. No process issued for the year after that. And Mr. Figueroa was stuck litigating this several years later after process did issue, alleging simply other violations that occurred more than a year after his probation ended. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. The case is submitted. We appreciate the argument.
Thank you.
We move on.